The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2023. There are only two people who have appeared on Millennial every single year so far. And that is, well, the other is Jared Taylor, who hopefully will be appearing in later on in the festival. But the other is Greg Johnson. And I think he'll be familiar to most of you, but Greg obviously is the runs the Countercurrents and is a writer, orator, publisher, and organizer. Obviously, I think everyone knows that. But nonetheless, Greg, welcome back to Millennial.
Oh, thank you for having me. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you as well. I'm sure that this year has been well. I suspect that the next year is going to be even more full with things, with events, but what would you say about 2023?
I'm really trying to review it and collect, collect my thoughts on it. And so I'm sort of in the middle of that process, but it's been an extremely eventful year. I think the main thing that has been asserting itself, jabbing me over and over again, is the fact that we're in an undeclared recession, and we have been for some time, really ever since COVID, with terrible inflation, and yet the economic news is, oh, things are supposedly good. Things are supposedly good, but prices are sky high. People are feeling miserable and pinched financially. It's happening throughout society. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in the United States. And it's manifesting itself in a real downturn in donations to the movement. So Countercurrents had a $300,000 fundraiser goal this year, and I think we're about 60% of the way there, and we've got 2 weeks left. We're not going to raise $140,000 in the next 2 weeks, obviously. This has been the case with a lot of other platforms and groups in the broader movement as well. And it's disturbing. It's concerning. It's concerning for the particular goals of the movement, but also it's more broadly concerning because they're just lying about it. The system might admit that there's a recession on in the first quarter of next year, but I've been seeing a recession through all of 2023. I've been seeing book sales down 60%. I've been seeing our fundraising massively underperforming. And this is at the same time that more people than ever have been coming to Countercurrents. We've had our best year yet in terms of traffic, but a lot of people are coming to get free stuff off the internet. And I have talked to other people in the movement, and they've been noticing the same patterns. It's not just at Countercurrents. And it's also outside the movement in other fields like the arts and so forth that depend on donations. They're seeing that this recession is real. So that's one of the biggest things. That's been the stone in my shoe that's been nagging me all year long. The recent events, the ongoing events in Gaza, have been enormously helpful, I think, in our cause to educate people. I think the events recently in Ireland have been enormously helpful. I think in 2023, And going on into 2024, the most important man in the world is Elon Musk, because of the somewhat freer space on Twitter and the amazing things that have been happening because of that. I think the movement's most valuable player this year is definitely Keith Woods. And I think that we're going to have a kind of debate piece, a pro and con piece at Countercurrents at the end of the year about whether we can say Candace Owens is our non-white ally of 2023. She's done some very useful things recently, said some very useful things, which I do applaud. So those are some of my thoughts about 2023. It's the decline is continuing. The borders have never been more open. The negative effects of multiculturalism and globalization have never been more blatant. The establishment has never been more arrogant at doubling down on these catastrophic policies, and they've never been more incompetent and stupid at the same time. I don't think a political establishment this stupid, this out of touch with reality, has much time left. And my fear is that we won't have enough time to inject our ideas broadly enough into the public consciousness that something better will crystallize when this horrible system cracks up.
See, a lot of people would say that they're not stupid, they're not incompetent, they're malicious. I would say that they're all three. I think that there absolutely is malice and an ideological and an anti-whiteness and an ethnic
I would agree with that too. I think that they are they're malicious, they're evil people, they're arrogant people, but I think they're also increasingly incompetent. I think that many of these people are maybe they're well educated, maybe they come from good homes or whatever, but I'm not very impressed. I'm not very impressed with the Tory party leadership. I'm not very impressed with the political leadership in America. I just think these people are entitled mediocrities who are in the grip of insane ideas and malicious ideas. I mean, some of them may not know what they're really doing. They may be just that stupid. They think that they're just doing the right thing. I'm willing to grant that that's a possibility. But most of these people are simply concerned with their own careers and their own advancement. And they're willing to say and do terrible things because that's how they climb the greasy pole. But when you have this... this woke ideology where they really believe that, putting people of color and women in positions of authority is the way to go. And anytime you say, social justice is a concern at our company. When social justice becomes a concern at your company, that competes with the actual business of your company. When social justice is a concern at the National Health Service, that competes with national health. When social justice is a concern at the in the highest levels of government, that competes with good government. And so they have a system that's self-liquidating. They even if they have evil ends, they are committed to an ideology that promotes diversity in its most superficial manifestations, in competition often with those evil ends. Now, I mean, ultimately, their evil end is that we disappear, and so putting diversity in positions of authority, well, that's the great replacement. But if they were smart about it, they would have competent people superintending this process, not affirmative action candidates. And so that's my great hope, that they are bastardizing themselves, the ruling class. They're miseducating their children. And these people are woefully uneducated. They're arrogant, they're empty-headed, and silly and often massively incompetent. And that's their ideology at work.
And one other thing, and this is a very cliched point to make, but I'm going to make it anyway, about the American administration is that the older people in it, and the thing is that there are so many old, like geriatric politicians in the American administration, they don't seem very impressive either. And some of them seem senile. And I don't just mean Biden. I've forgotten the guy's name who he had that episode where it looked like he was having a stroke.
I forget him. The man who looks like a bloated dead turtle. Mitch McConnell.
He just doesn't seem very bright. I don't really understand what's going on there. But I don't want to focus on him because it seems to be a sort of general phenomenon that we've got this cadre of people in DC, in the American government, leaving aside the diversity hires, leaving aside the woke millennials and the younger morons. The older ones seem awful as well.
Well, they're awful because they've gone stale. They're just old. Joe Biden was always a nutcase. He was always a goofball. He was always saying stupid things. He was plagiarizing speeches. He was corrupt, but he was sharp. There was a time when Joe Biden was sharp, and now he's just gaga. The same could be said with people like Nancy Pelosi. There was a time when Nancy Pelosi was sharp and cunning, and so on and so forth. But what's happened is these selfish old people have been clinging to power at the expense of the future. That's the mark of a sick society, where you're ruled by people where the old consume the future of the young. And they are clinging to power. They'll have to be carried out and put in boxes, like Dianne Feinstein was. Dianne Feinstein's finally dead. She was so senile at the end that her aides were basically telling her how to vote.
Oh my God.
She was so senile at the end that her daughter, I think it was her daughter, had power of attorney, yet she had power over the government of America.
That cannot be right. That, how can that be a good way to... Like, there's something wrong with a political system that enables people and encourages people to stay around for so long. I think there's an age when someone should step back from this stuff, and they can still be an advisor, but they shouldn't be actively handling power.
And they should be grooming people to take their place. They should have a group of people, a cadre of people who are one generation younger than them that they have mentored for years and they pass power to. That's the natural order of things. That's a healthy form of society. We have a gerontocracy where these selfish old people, and this is true in both parties, have not really mentored their replacements. And now they are being surrounded by, and in some sense, in some ways controlled by, in the case of somebody like Biden, people who are two generations younger than them, who have no education. They've just had a modern politically correct education, no culture, just pop culture swill. A lot of them are black and brown and female, and maybe not the best people for the job. And this is who they're handing things over to. They have been fanatical about, for years, crushing people that they thought were rising too fast, who could be their rivals. And now they're approaching death and they don't have anybody to take over except basically yes men, creatures. They have their creatures. And the creatures they have made are not very impressive, and they don't have much of a future. And the system that they take over has very little future.
Yeah, and another one would be Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But when did she die? My God, she actually died 3 years ago. That's been a lot. I thought it was that. I thought it was much more recent. But yeah, she was another one who just seemed to be in a dreadful state by the end. In fact, there were, for about a year, there were rumors that she'd already died. But officially, she still had power.
Yeah.
Very strange. Not a good way to have a society. I suppose, well, would you like to make any general remarks about the Biden presidency, the administration this year, and its behavior this year?
No, I've been kind of checked out. I wouldn't have a sense of what was Biden doing in 2022 as opposed to 2023. That's not how I look at things, you know?
Yeah, I know. It's more about which memes about him were going on at that time this year.
Yeah. Yeah. I would have to be a real American politics junkie to be able to frame something like that, to mince things up so finely that I can tell the difference between Biden vintage 2023 and 2022. I could certainly say that Biden was a much sharper politician when he was debating as the VP for Barack Obama.
It's hard to believe it's the same guy. He just seems so physically different.
Yeah.
I mean, and I know that there is...
Age is so unkind. This is what we all have to look forward to, more or less.
I know, and I'm certainly not mocking him for being old. I mean, for heaven's sake, it's going to happen.
No, I mock him for being evil and out of touch and selfish.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. He's perfectly content to being a figurehead and an empty shell, as long as they salute him. And he's got the prerogatives and the pomp of office. He's perfectly content to be this empty shell and a puppet. And that's rather pathetic. He's the only thing left of this guy is his ambition. He's just a sort of a husk of a human being. There was never much good in him to begin with. I mean, he's a fucking pedophile. Pardon my French, but and that's one of the least of his problems. You know, every politician like him has blood up to his elbows by this stage of his career. They're absolute catastrophes. When you're a president, you've got blood on your hands in terms of wars and interventions and things like that. He's been a political insider for a long, long time. He's a dirty person, and now he's just this empty, senile shell of this dirty political careerist, and we have to pretend like this guy is good. Why? Because, well, it's the only alternative to the fascist Trump.
And also another
the
thing.
The silliness.
Just to bring this into focus, the fact that he doesn't seem to have any political convictions at all. I don't know if anyone could say, what does Joe Biden stand for at all? I don't think I've ever heard anyone actually making a case that he does have any politics of his own.
Well, he has evolved. That's how they put it. He's grown. He's evolved. And basically, he's evolved along with the hive mind on Twitter and in the mainstream media, the liberal hive mind. And so their principles of the day are his principles. So, yeah, it's so sad. America could have been a civilization that dwarfed Greece and Rome. And this is what we've come to in a little more than 200 years. It's just so sad.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, to get back to a more upbeat topic, perhaps, you said that... I think he said that the man of the year was Elon Musk. I can't remember the phrase he used.
Well, I just said I think he's the most important person in the world.
Right.
And I found that I know a guy who knows Elon Musk. Well, sort of, you know. And when he told me this, I said, "You mean I'm only 2 degrees of separation from Elon Musk?" And he said, "Yes, sort of." And it's like, okay, you know, it's tenuous, but you are now the most important person in the world to me, because he's the most important person in the world right now because of what he's doing on Twitter. And I can't call it X. I like, you know, the verb form, tweeting things out. Do we X things out now? That doesn't sound like a positive thing. It sounds like
how they're going to make that work. I'm just going to stick with Twitter until the bitter end.
Yeah, I mean, I have to deal with so many people, and we all have a Dunbar number, and that's the number of names that you can retain. And when half the people that you know have two or more names that they use, it gets ridiculous. And I don't think I've had a particularly large Dunbar number myself. And so, yeah, I just resent any kind of rebrands. I understand when dissidents have to use various pen names and things like that, but rebranding Twitter as X. I mean, X is associated with porn. There's tons of porn on Twitter, for that matter.
Yeah, but even without that, if it were just the letter H, it would be just as shit. It's pointless crap. There's nothing there. It's empty. No, it's a crap name.
It should be the letter N. The mind reels, anyway.
Well, let's get to the matter. And it's been discussed several times on Millennial already, probably will be again. But your own take on the situation with Twitter and freedom of speech and Silicon Valley and so forth.
Well, I think there's more freedom of speech objectively on Twitter than there was before Elon Musk came on board. I say that as a guy whose Twitter account, my Greg Johnson PhD Twitter account, which is my normie Twitter account that I basically created just so I could stalk some jerks who had blocked the Countercurrents account. Just to be perfectly frank, this is one of the reasons people create anons. I had two Twitter accounts that I controlled. One was the New Right America account, which is the Countercurrents business account. That was set up way back when, I guess around 2010, when Countercurrents went live, by Michael Polignano. And he set it up in such a way that everything that was posted on our then Facebook page would be automatically tweeted. And so sometime, I think it was in 2014, I logged in to the Twitter account for the first time, and I had tweeted all this stuff automatically. It was just a, you know, I never took it very seriously. In other words, it took me years to actually log into the thing. But you know, I was growing a following there. I had more than 20,000 followers before it was taken down in the late pre-Musk era. But I had held on to my small Dr. Greg Johnson or Greg Johnson PhD account. My personal account. And so that sort of grew. And then it was taken down, I think it was in December of last year, because I did a reading of my piece, In Your Heart, You Know Ye's Right, about what Kanye West was up to a year ago. And there was a little quote from that somebody made a video with, and put the video out on YouTube, and I put it on my account, and my account got showed immediately. And I thought, okay, well, that's interesting. And so I am one of the people, like Kevin MacDonald, like James Edwards, who was banned after Musk took over. And my original account has never been brought back. The business account, the Countercurrents account. So if I were just, you know, totally self-absorbed and thought that the fate of the world depended on me, I would be angry and loath to give him any credit. But the world's bigger than me. And there is a lot of truth-telling going on Twitter right now. And it's a beautiful thing. And the interactions between Elon Musk and Keith Woods have been enormously useful. Elon Musk obviously is adjacent to our sphere in some ways and overlaps with it. And he's encountered that on Twitter. And that's huge. When the richest man in the world is liking stuff and talking about, yes, they're trying to exterminate you, that kind of stuff. That's extremely important. And yes, he banned the ADL thing, his lawsuit. Well, what's happened to that? A lot of people have been cynical about him and said, well, he won't follow through on this. It doesn't matter if he doesn't follow through on it. What matters is the messaging and the conversations that take place. What matters is the red pilling that takes place when you see the richest guy in the world being beaten up by these crazed, angry, self-righteous, hyper-ethnocentric would-be censors and boycotters and bullies. That's hugely, hugely educational. And so I think that Twitter is now the great red-pilling machine, even without me, on it. And I think it was Joel Davis who said it very nicely. He said, get all of your normie friends on Twitter. Twitter is now the new 4chan, the new poll. Get them on Twitter and it will radicalize them. And I think he's probably right about that. So I'm very, very excited about what's happening. And it would be fun to actually be able to take part in it. It would be fun to have my old accounts back, my 20,000, almost 25,000, I think, followers on the New Right America account. And I think 6 or 7,000 on my personal account. I would like to get those accounts back. And but even if I'm not taking part, I still think the world is saving itself and healing itself. And part of that activity, an important part, is happening on Twitter.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a general feeling of healing. Yeah, that would be the right word. And it's very nice to see. There are people who still haven't been restored, and of course they should be. I actually do think that he's going to restore almost everyone. There might be a specific exemption for organizations, and I think that's probably demanded by the various national governments. I suspect it's not coming from within Twitter, the desire to ban various political parties and so on. I'm sure it'll be the national government. But as for individuals, I suspect that everyone eventually will get their account back. But I might be wrong.
I really like to get my account back because fun stuff is happening. Fun stuff is going on Twitter.
Well, you know, I've got to
and
say
it's that. Useful. It's not just fun, it's useful.
I'll just give you an example of how it's useful. I'll use like Millennial as an example. This on Odyssey, this stream has 350 viewers. And on Telegram, it has, 20 viewers. And on Twitter, it has 40 viewers. But later on, at the end, it will say it has several thousand.
Huh.
Because it always does. And I don't know if that's people who have tuned in throughout and then just stayed for 5 minutes. I don't know. But at the end of each stream, it says it always says about 5,000.
Wow.
So that's greater than either of the other two platforms by a long way. So, yeah it looks good. It's definitely very easy to share on Twitter. And it also goes automatically to there as well. And it's very cool. But this is only the start. It's important to say that as well. I think that the video side of it will be probably hugely expanded next year. If he's got any sense, he really... He absolutely should. do that. Yeah. Because I think it can actually take over from YouTube.
YouTube is so hated, even by people who are making handsome livings on it. They hate it. Everybody hates that platform. I don't think I've looked at YouTube in a year, probably. No, wait. Somebody sent me a link to the latest Dune trailer, and I guess that was on YouTube. But I don't go there unless I accidentally click a link that takes me there. It has no appeal whatsoever.
Yeah. I still use it for music. But it's not actually that good for music either anymore, because the algorithm just repeats the same three songs in a loop. And they've broken that. I don't know why. But maybe that's because I don't have an account. I don't know. But my point is, YouTube has... I think it's sort of relinquished its place, not just voluntarily, but proudly. It's relinquished its place as the forum for political discourse and intellectual discourse online. It was that. There was a lovely, very fun period that I think a lot of us will always have nostalgia for. That moment, 2013 to 2017, where it was endless hangouts, as they were called.
Yeah.
And it was so easy to do. It was so simple. It was rough and ready. I loved it because it was just this tool that was built into YouTube that enabled you to record a live conversation with someone with up to 10 people. It's so basic and primitive, but so easy to use. And God knows how many hours of discussion were recorded with Google Hangouts. But the point is that one way or another, YouTube was this place, this ecosystem where so much was going on. And I would love it to be that again, but the price of that is the gun at your head.
Yeah.
The price of getting my YouTube channel back, let's say that they gave it back to me tomorrow, I would then have all the bloody worrying again that I could lose it at any time. If I say the wrong thing, if I use the wrong word or structure a sentence in a particular way by accident, I could lose the whole thing. I mean, it was just insane. Well, I say insane. It was Kafka-esque and totality. Like, you just did not know what the hell was going to happen. And when I finally got banned, it was more of a relief. I mean, it was sad, but not greatly. I mean, it wasn't devastating, you know. And there definitely was a sense of relief. It's happened now. I don't have to worry anymore. Now, what kind of bloody platform is that? I mean, if that's how it is to be on that platform, maybe it's just a fucking crap platform.
Yeah, it's a crap platform, and it deserves to die.
Yeah.
It deserves to go the way of MySpace. Remember the MySpace generation?
The thing is, there was nothing actually wrong with MySpace. It was just that Facebook took over. MySpace in and of itself was fine for what it was. But Facebook just was, I think, more normie friendly. It was, boomers could get into it. You didn't have to be into any music or whatever. Whereas MySpace was sort of tied to that. Facebook was just for grannies and aunts and uncles and, you know, all that. So everyone could get into that. And that's what killed MySpace. Bebo was another one.
I never even heard of that.
Yeah, it was at the same time. I'm sure there were others that I've now forgotten about completely. But that was what happened. It wasn't that MySpace was crap. And it certainly wasn't that it was being censorious. No, YouTube killed itself. You know, MySpace didn't kill itself, but YouTube did. Certainly as a political... I mean, obviously, there are still the DIY videos, the cat videos, the prank videos. But for any sort of discourse, if you fit into YouTube, you should be kind of embarrassed, because it means that you're completely neutered. It means that you're saying nothing of any intellectual weight or what's the word? I always forget this word. Valence? Valence?
Valence, yeah.
Yeah. That's
so. How many billion views has that video with the dog talking about the maple flavor bacon gotten on YouTube?
I don't know. I'm frightened to look. But that's to do with what the masses like, and we know that they will always gravitate to drivel.
Yeah, I admit that I probably viewed that 50 times.
Guilty pleasure. I'll confess that I do have a similar one. There was this clip that was released, and it was gross. It was a guy in China stepping out of an elevator and vomiting, and then he slipped. He slipped in his own vomit. It's just absolutely farcical. It's kind of very low grade, very low brow, but it was something that was very amusing to me for a while. But anyway. So let's get back to this. So I think Twitter could take over from YouTube in that sense. I think it kind of already is. There's the specific phenomenon of spaces, which I think pre-existed Musk taking it over. I'm not sure about that. I'm pretty sure it was there already. And there's just been so much, especially in the last few months, for obvious reasons. I've listened to God knows how many Twitter spaces and taken part in a few as well. But I think the whole platform is rejuvenating. It's restoring the internet to what it was 10 years ago in terms of the presumption of freedom of speech. Now, obviously, platforms will resist this in different ways, but I think that is now the trend. Again, I might turn out to be wrong, but this seems to be the direction now. Would you say that I'm being too optimistic there?
No, I don't think so. I do think that we have to keep Elon Musk alive. But I think the trend isn't going in the right direction. And I think there's a constituency for this. So I am optimistic. I'm optimistic that our ideas are going to get closer and closer to the mainstream, that the establishment will be increasingly incapable of covering up the ills that their policies are creating. This is going to cause all kinds of spontaneous, beautiful, populist interventions and uprisings and demonstrations. And that will further encourage others to imitate them. And we're getting into a virtuous cycle where
I agree.
Actually. That is a great place to be in. And they're in a vicious cycle.
Yeah. You see, what I've noticed is a lot of the fake, like if you look at Tommy Robinson, they brought him back on Twitter and it worked for, you know, he was popular with the types of people that he was popular with in the past, but he hasn't taken over Twitter. You know, it's like the old alt-light, people no longer buy their shtick. You know, it's kind of past that. They've been brought back, a few of them, as sort of relics to hopefully steer people away from identitarianism and from realizing the JQ and so forth. But I don't think it's working at all.
Yeah. No.
And that interests me. It interests me that why has all this attempt to revivify, to rejuvenate the alt-light. Why has that not worked? And I think it's just because it was something of 2015-16 and it simply no longer works. It no longer persuades in 2023.
No. We, in part, have inoculated people against their lame memes. And I think people have just grown to think that, the thing that fed the alt-light and that feeds normie Republicans is the idea that they can somehow get everything that they want without crossing the line into thought crime and racism, especially the evil of racism. They're constantly trying to find ways of showing that they're good little boys and girls and that you can have free markets and be anti-racist. You can have sound fiscal Republican government and lots of wars in the Middle East and all these things that Republicans stand for. And you can have black women as their front, as the fronts for that. This is so irresistible to the normie mind. Why? Because it's easy that way, right? They sense that, well, there are these extremely strong moral prohibitions against anything that smacks of racism. Okay, well, we can handle that. We're gonna get Caitlyn Jenner to run for a Republican office, right? So Caitlyn Jenner will come out with the same fake neoliberal neocon platitudes that all these other people come out with, but it'll be progressive and somehow morally unimpeachable. It's a dumb hat trick, and it's increasingly wearing thin. Of course, the actual parties are going to have to be carried out dead before they'll stop doing this. But you know, pundits, of course, go along with this. But in the freer sphere of online punditry, it's just increasingly lame. Even Charlie Kirk doesn't do that stuff the way he used to. He realizes that if he were Charlie Kirk 2019, he would have no audience.
Yeah.
Or a much smaller audience. He would just be really uncool.
And I think the same is true of Candace Owens and Matt Walsh as well.
Yeah. Yeah. They've been growing. Now, a lot of people will try and be dismissive of their say they're not sincere or whatever. I tire of that. I don't know what's in people's hearts. I don't know what their ultimate agenda is. But if Matt Walsh is talking about anti-whiteness, that's a victory for us. Even if his paycheck is signed by Ben Shapiro. So yeah. This is good.
Yeah, I think that's true. Another one would be Alex Jones. And I've just this moment seen a Telegram post by Fulltide saying Alex Jones back on Twitter claiming that the globalist elite are eugenicists who want worldwide depopulation. Would a eugenicist elite hell-bent on global depopulation spend 8 decades subsidizing population growth among the least, among Africans?
Yeah. It's so dumb.
Yeah. And Alex Jones has said it like the Chi-Com stuff, right? They run Hollywood. This kind of, you know, I don't hate Alex Jones. I just wonder whether he knows, whether he is deliberately or accidentally talking bollocks.
I think he's a dishonest guy. I don't like Alex Jones. I don't like him because I think he's a liar. I think he makes stuff up. And the number of crazy sounding things that he said over the years that have actually been correct, though, is somewhat alarming. I'm kind of glad he's back on Twitter, but it's all purple pill dogma. But, you know, he almost tore his shirt off a few weeks ago talking about, you know, addressing himself to the Jews. And I thought that was great. He was saying things like, you're destroying the country. You're attacking me and hating me because my skin is white. I have tried to be your friend. You're preaching evil. You're bringing all these negative consequences on yourselves. I was super, super busy at the time, and I just could not flog myself into writing a piece. But I wanted to write a piece, an open letter to Alex Jones, and just try and get it seen. It was a moment of rare candor. And it's just amazing, though, the lengths to which people will lie to themselves and others to be good in scare quotes, by this absurd standard that we're ruled by, which is that racism is a wonderful thing as long as it's non-whites sticking it to white people. But woe if any white person fights back. White people can never take their own side in a racial fight, but everybody else has their knives out for us. That's the code that we're supposed to conduct ourselves by. It's absolutely absurd. It's heinous. And of course, it's designed to make us lose. If we continue this game, we will lose everything and be replaced. And that's the reason why this is in place. And yet these fools will go to any lengths to stay, quote unquote, good by playing that game. We cannot play that game anymore. Hey, are you there? Have I lost you?
Sorry, I accidentally muted myself when I meant to unmute. So I would like to switch it to probably the biggest story from this year, and I think it links with what you were just saying because it directly impacts the matter of white identity and identity politics. That is Gaza, the Gaza conflict over the last few months. I think that this has highlighted the enormous hypocrisy of the Jewish lobby, the Zionist lobby specifically, because it is specific. They certainly believe in identity politics. They certainly believe in homeland, Heimat. They certainly believe in ethnic, I would say an ethnic supremacism, especially when they're talking about just displacing, just removing the Palestinians from their ancient homeland, or even massacring them.
Yes.
That's an astonishing, genocidal. So I think it's happened, perhaps if it had happened, and this might seem crazy, but perhaps if Twitter was still as it was a year ago or 2 years ago, this conflict wouldn't have had the effects that it has had. I don't know. I think it also relied on the change that's occurred. I think occurred not just because of Twitter, the free speech on there. I think it also occurred because of the woke, non-white atmosphere on college campuses in America. The faculty is now being largely non-white and non-Jewish or anti-Zionist Jewish. So it's for various reasons. But either way, the effect of all of this, the Gaza conflict, has been to expose that the Jews do have identity politics, and there is an enormous hypocrisy in them preaching, and I'm talking here about right-wing Jews, preaching values and principles for our countries while they have ethnic supremacism in Israel. What would you say about all of that?
Well, I agree. It's been a very clarifying time. It's a teachable moment, to use that pretentious libtard language. It's an opportunity for us to get our message out. And never has Jewish bloodlust and hysteria and hypocrisy been clearer. And yes, I do think that greater freedom on Twitter has been helpful. But I think, yes, a lot of the groundwork for this has been laid by the Great Replacement that Jews themselves have been the chief promoters of. And these people were brought in. We predicted that this would not go well for them. These people were brought in to replace white people. Why? Because Jews feel threatened by white people. They would like to replace any relatively homogeneous European society with a multicultural, multiracial dystopia because they feel less exposed in that kind of society. They're afraid of us.
In their own words. I mean, this is not an anti-Semitic rant from Greg here. Just today, I watched a clip of Barbara Lerner-Spector saying very thing in herself, straight from his mouth, so to speak.
Yeah, they're very open and candid about this. They fear white populism and nationalism, and so they try and dilute that with multiculturalism. Well, it hasn't worked. And they have been bringing in people who are hostile to them and installing them in positions of responsibility, primarily just to eject white people. The main reason for affirmative action, ultimately, is not to redress ancient grievances and stuff like that. It's to remove white men from positions of authority in white societies so that eventually, in some institutions, the only quote-unquote white people will be Jews. They're the ones who are pushing this sort of musical chairs kind of thing where they, you know, when there's a Jewish candidate, suddenly merit is the only thing that matters. When there is a white candidate, they start thinking, well, we really should have a little more diversity around here. And so they use this as a way of squeezing out their rivals from positions of influence in the most influential sectors of society. And they've been doing it for decades. But now they've found that the golem that they have created, this entitled affirmative action cast around them, is not particularly pro-Jewish.
And it's also something that we feel guilty about the Holocaust.
No. They don't feel guilty about that at all. They're not susceptible to the Jewish mind control and manipulation techniques that white people are. If Jews had only just sort of learned to love white people, they would be riding high in the world, but they can't do that. They hate us, they despise us, they fear us, and they have been working to engineer our downfall in every one of our homelands, and now their own security, which was supposed to be increased by multiculturalism, is being undermined by multiculturalism. We've been saying this, we've been predicting this for a long, long time. The whole counter-jihad movement, that was an attempt by polite, conservative-minded people who wanted to color within Semitically correct lines to say, maybe we shouldn't be bringing these Muslims into Europe. No Arabia for us. Wouldn't it be bad for Jews? They've been saying that for more than a decade. And finally, after the Gaza thing, it seems like it's sunk in to some Jews. And now they're very, very concerned about this. I love the loyalty oaths now, the laws that are being put in place in France, in Germany, in the UK. You can rise to positions of power in those societies while hating those societies by overflowing with contempt for Germans or the French or the white British people. You can rise to the top. But now these societies are saying you've got to be pro-Jewish, right? You can be anti-English in England, but you can't be anti-Jewish. Who does that tell you is ruling those societies? There is this old idea of lèse majesté that, you know, the high treason is basically simply insulting the ruler. That's the idea. Well, what does it tell you when it's high treason to insult Jews, but it's perfectly okay to insult the English in England? It means that they are de facto the rulers. They're the ones whose interests matter the most. This has all been revealed beautifully recently. I love watching the Jewish billionaire class, to quote Finkelstein, the Jewish billionaire class going at the Ivy Leagues now. I love to see our enemies fighting with one another. And the more they're fighting with one another, the less they have time and energy and resources to oppress us. So, and of course, they degrade one another's power. For a very long time, Jews and Muslims within white societies were allies. They worked together against the white majority. Now that's not the case anymore. Now they're fighting with one another, and that weakens both of those parties in their struggles to displace us. So this is a huge opportunity, which I hope we will not waste like we waste so many other opportunities.
Yeah. I should say, for the sake of legal purposes, Greg said that Jews hate us and fear us. Obviously, we don't mean all Jews. I'm sure that some of Greg's best friends are Jewish. So just for the sake of, you know, not making blanket statements.
Yes, exactly.
That caveat.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but I do agree. It's brought all of this into focus. I think it's honestly done more damage to a certain cause that you could say international, the diaspora Jewish, well, certainly the Zionist Jews, but also the as you say, it's done a lot, but doesn't matter. I don't need to be specific here because it's done damage all over the place.
Yeah.
It's done more damage than we did in years. Netanyahu's decision has done more damage in a couple of months than we did or could have hoped to do to this force that opposes us in years.
Yeah, but his errors have been received and understood today in ways that have been shaped by our efforts over the years. I'm convinced of that. Memes that came from our sphere. In 2011, two memes were coined. One was white genocide, the other was the Great Replacement. Now those memes have traveled all the way to the Republican mainstream. Recently, there was an interview, a conversation with Tucker Carlson, who's been extremely disappointing generally since he lost his job at Fox and has been streaming on X. Frody Bidyard calls him Alex Jones Jr., which is a good way of describing what's wrong with Tucker.
It's worse than that.
Yeah. Well,
the tension is so much greater.
Oh, I know. But in this conversation with Candace Owens, he was talking about, why are these rich Jews going after Harvard and Columbia over anti-Semitism? They were totally fine funding anti-white hate.
Yeah.
Right?
For someone like Tucker Carlson to say that in 2015, 16 would have been unthinkable.
He actually said that gradually he started to hate them. He didn't
actually say that, did he?
Yeah. Those very words, but he started hating them. The white genocide meme crept in there. He did the Great Replacement in 2021, but he actually was talking about genocide against white people. That would not have happened were it not for the efforts of people like you and me. Now, we can't claim sole credit. We're part of a team, we're part of a network, we're part of a phenomenon. And many of us, some of us totally anonymous, others out there under our own names, have been beavering away or tunneling away in the internet and shifting these ideas closer and closer to the mainstream. It wouldn't have happened without our movement. And I think that a lot of the cold or cool reception of what's going on by Jews in Gaza and Jews around the world in response to it has been prepared by our efforts as well. So I'm very happy about that. It's a job well done. We've done a lot, and we just need to keep doing more. we need to get doing more. And it's getting closer and closer to the point where these things will be openly talked about. People will not back down. And then policy will have to shift.
Yeah, I agree. And as an example of that, I think that, and I said this last night with Red Ice, I think that the terms racist, anti-Semitic, white supremacist, these just don't have the same punch, the same weight that they used to have.
Yeah, and people now just talk about things being anti-white.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, and anti-white has joined the pantheon of sins, and frankly, most white people. Well, I wouldn't say most white people, but put it this way: any white person who says this is anti-white and that's bad, they have pretty much lost any concern with the sins of racism. At this point, if they're pushing back against anti-whiteness, they're taking their own side. And that's very, very encouraging. And courage is contagious. That's what encouragement means. You get courage from other people. Now we're seeing people like Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens and Charlie Kirk crossing into identitarian territory in public, and they can do that because they're looking around at one another and they're gaining courage from one another. And again, the most important person for creating this atmosphere is Elon Musk. He may be very purple-pilled in his own thinking, but he's creating an atmosphere, an environment in which we can win.
I agree. Do you remember in 2018, 19, there was an academic paper published about the alternative influencer network?
Yeah, I remember that vaguely. I forget the authors of that.
Yeah, I was actually one of the biggest. I have to say, I didn't intend to say this, but it's just occurred to me, so I will make this boast, that I was one of the biggest figures on that network, because really just because of Millennial. It wasn't because of anything else. It was because of Millennial. So I was connected to so many other people in the network. So I was one of the biggest nodes.
You are. You are a great connector. And I value connectors. Connectors are golden. Years ago, I think it was 2014, maybe 2015, I read a rather antiquated book, a pre-internet era book, for all intents and purposes, by Malcolm Gladwell, called Tipping Point, about how things go viral. And I've written a review of it. It's up at Countercurrents. It's also reprinted in the second edition of my Confessions of a Reluctant Hater. I think it's a tremendously important book. And he talks about three types of people that are important for ideas going viral. One is basically connectors, people who have broad social networks. Another is mavens. I would just call them spurgs, basically, in contemporary speak. They're just people who are absolute masters of a particular topic, right? They don't have to be credentialed or anything. They can be total amateurs, but they absolutely master a particular topic, and they can put the information out there. And then the third are salesmen. And I think our movement is extremely effective with the mavens. We've got lots of good mavens. We have some amazing connectors, and we have some pretty good salesmen. I wish we had more salesmen. That's something that we need to work on, honestly. But you're one of the better connectors, and I realized how foolishly snobbish I was about connectors when I read this book, because I remember this one guy who's actually still a player and now, in my view, a highly valued player. I remember years ago, he would sit in my office when I was in Atlanta. He'd sit on the sofa in my office, and he would have these breathless 30-second conversations with people. And it was like, hey, hi, how you doing? Ta-da, bop, 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 boom. And he'd be off the phone. And I just like shake my head, just thinking, I can't imagine the value of so many shallow relationships. Well, it turns out this guy, that is one of the traits of the connector. The connector, because he has a broad net, can't have as deep a connection with everybody as somebody who has a narrower social circle. And it's a trade-off. It's just a fundamental trade-off. However, people who have a great ability to relate to a lot of people, and have a lot of names in their Rolodex and keep in touch, keep these networks active, they are absolutely golden. And this is a guy, you know, that I will call. I'll say, I need to get a meme to Alex Jones. You know, and he would know how to get something to Alex Jones or, you know, any number of other people. He's just an amazing connector. And I came to appreciate that. And I started doing an inventory of connectivity in my life. And this was in 2014. It was shortly after the death of a friend in October of 2014. And I realized this friend of mine had been phenomenally well connected. And I had never tried to use his connectivity for any purposes. And I just realized, boy, what a dope I am. You know, it's like, I was always kind of hoping that maybe if I was with him, I'd bump into one of these people, right? But I never tried to actually use that connectivity. And I just came to appreciate the people who are masters of that. It is a genuinely important feature of any movement that wants to change the world. It's at the core of politics. The people who rule us. Okay, there was an interesting study about social networks and connectivity, and said that the average Jew, I think, is 10 times more networked and connected than the average non-Jew in America. There's a reason why they're so influential. They're so networked. Politics is about networking, and the people who rule us, they meet face to face.
Getting anything done is a matter of networking.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, and the most important things, you know, as well as the most trivial things, you want to put on a brony convention. You get the network going, or you want to change the world. You get the network going. It's an absolutely crucial tool. The way that we're ruled is we're ruled by parasites, basically, that try to undermine the connectivity of everybody in the society, poison the connectivity, isolate people. They would like us isolated. They would like nothing more than us going back to the pre-internet era where we were isolated in our apartments watching the drivel that they were programming on the TV. They never, I think, would have allowed social media or the internet to get going if they had seen how devastating that has been for their power. But the people who want us isolated and consuming, media drivel that they program, they meet face to face. That's how we're ruled.
Oh, yeah. They have conferences and seminars and symposia and God knows what else.
Dinners. They the fate of nations is determined over dinners. And we have to be that networked and that face to face. This is why I COVID was such a disaster. It was such a setback for our movement. It sort of set back everybody pretty much the same because everybody's ability to travel and network was compromised. But it's been especially bad, I think, for our movement. Just thinking of the European scene, before COVID, there were all these European conferences to go to. They still haven't sprung back to the extent that they were before COVID. That's not good.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there are different things to say about that. I wouldn't be surprised if it does come back in time in the next couple of years. I wouldn't be surprised. Probably new organizations mostly, because some of the others are defunct now, unfortunately. But I wouldn't be surprised. The threat prior to COVID was Antifa. And this is an important thing, that it did actually retard things prior to COVID. It was already becoming very, I mean, remember what happened to you in Oslo, for example.
Oh, yeah. Or in Copenhagen before that, where I couldn't even get into the venue.
Yeah, yeah.
I had such a great speech prepared. It's been published. It's published as In Defense of Populism.
Yeah, I was getting really into it. And I thought that the speeches were an opportunity to produce a video or a recording at the least that would outlast the event, the conference. So if you're going to take the trouble to write a speech and then go to the event, which means often paying for your own hotel and your flight and everything, well, you might as well record it. Because then that multiplies how many people see it by 100 or even 1,000. So I took it very seriously, and I wanted the speeches to be recorded very well because of all this. I thought it was an opportunity. And so I was really into it, but I think I was, you know, by the time it petered out, I was very much over. Like, I think I'd done too much. I was doing like 3 or 4 speeches a year, and it was ridiculous. Really, it was too much. But that's a separate issue. But see, the reason I brought up the Alternative Influencer Network was not just to boast that I was one of the biggest nodes on it, because that was just something that occurred to me. The reason I brought it up was because it linked with what you were saying. That we have this, especially because of Twitter, these ideas can now form in a way that they couldn't while under the regime of censorship on social. That really, you know, they knew what they were doing. And so there's no point in hiding or denying that they were correct in their thinking. They were correct. If you censor and censor and censor, you will eventually severely retard the spreading of an idea. And if you deplatform, then you also demoralize. You also debank, you defund. All of these things go together, which leads people eventually to just throw in the towel because it's just too difficult. It's too much work. It's for too little returns. So the left, or the regime, whatever you want to call them, knew what they were doing, and they were correct in their strategy. And so I think it's safe to say that the Alternative Influencer Network was also correct. They were right. There was a pipeline, or there were many pipelines. And of course, because that's how ideas travel. I mean, it's nothing specific to us, to the dissident right or the alt-right, as it was. It's the same way that left-wing ideas travel, all ideas. So they were correct. And this is why it was important for us to be on social media. And so that's why I didn't like it when people would say that, you know, Twitter doesn't matter, it's not real life and this kind of thing. And it's why they wanted us off there. And it's why it's great that we're now back on there. Apart from any other like moral concerns about the ethics of denying people freedom of speech, just on a practical matter, if you're trying to spread ideas, then this is very good. And so we're now poised, potentially, we're poised to really go into another gear where our Twitter accounts are going to grow. And I don't have any particular target for my Twitter account. You know, I'm just under 30,000 just now, 29. I don't know. And I don't really care. In that sense, size doesn't matter. You can't afford to obsess over this. I just want our ideas to get out there so that society has to respond, has to take them on board to some extent, has to adapt, because the current status quo is absolutely cancerous. I mean, it's the image I showed earlier. It's this. This is the status quo. If you think that that's okay, you're mad. This has to end. This is absolutely awful. And so I think that you can understand why our opponents are so mad at Elon Musk, because purple-pilled though he is, he does genuinely believe in freedom of speech. I think he does genuinely believe in the marketplace of ideas. And our ideas will win. And if there is a level playing field, our ideas will win. It's really as simple as that. And then they know that. That's why they want to censor us.
Absolutely. I don't know what it's like being a person who's clinging to something, clinging to power based on lies. I don't know what it's like to be that kind of person. I wouldn't want to be that kind of person. Yeah,
I would think it would be very depressing, but I think the types of people we're talking about aren't really, they don't really care.
Yeah.
They're not bothered about the truth.
Yeah, absolutely. So are people sending in super chats? Are there any questions here?
Yes, there are a few. But before we get onto that, I would like to ask you about prospects for the near future. We've already talked about the freedom of speech issue. Specifically, I wanted to ask about Trump 2024. Do you have any thoughts about, because this will have happened by the time of next millennial. I'm guessing in November as usual. So what would you think, what do you expect is going to happen in 2024?
I wrote a piece at Countercurrents called Trump 2024, a bad idea whose time has come.
It's a good title.
Yeah, it's a bad idea. There's nothing that can stop an idea whose time has come. And unfortunately, that applies to bad ideas as well as good ones. I just think it's a bad idea. And I think it's an unstoppable bad idea. I had a lot of hope for Trump, but it's just obvious that my hopes were inflated, put it that way, groundless. As I put it in one of my pieces, maybe Martin Heidegger really was the last philosopher with good political judgment, because I certainly was taken in by Trump. I just think he's an unprincipled egomaniac. I don't think he will really save America or do the things necessary to save America. I think he did many good things simply by bringing up issues. But at the end of his presidency, it occurred to me that the greatest thing he did was the day he declared his candidacy, when he put globalization and multiculturalism and immigration on the table as issues to be debated. Because the entire establishment, Republican and Democrat, was never going to compete on that. They had a gentleman's agreement. They were not going to compete on multiculturalism, economic globalization, etc. Those things were going to go forward no matter who was in power. They were going to compete on other stuff. And he gave the people what they wanted, to the extent that he got the Republicans to compete on that and debate on that. And once the debate was going, he's terribly inarticulate, but he couldn't help but win. And he changed the Republican Party. He sounded issues that most white Republicans wanted to hear and wanted to talk about and weren't having represented by the party. And so that, I think, is a permanent change. We're not going to go back to sleep. We're not going to allow them to go back to the old Republican stuff of basically tax cuts for the rich and wars for Israel and open borders and occasionally talking about the flag, right? That kind of stuff. We're not going to go back to that. And I think that that's a permanent step forward. Once he got into office, he just fiddled around and wasted all of the opportunities with very, very foolish staffing choices and extremely weak and naive decisions in dealing with the Congress and the bureaucracy. He should have fired thousands of people. He didn't do that. He should have taken these generals and fired them for insubordination. court-martial them if necessary. He didn't do any of that. It was he was an extremely weak figure. Then I saw this story a week ago or so that he's considering having Jared Kushner staff his administration. Well, the fool, the absolute fool. I think it was said about the Bourbons. They learned nothing from the revolution, right? They learned nothing, but they forgot nothing.
It's meaning, just unbelievable. If you were to say, what is the number one mistake that he could make?
That would be it.
It would be it. It would be bringing that fucking
weasel. Yeah. That greedy, disloyal weasel into a position of power.
Every piece of advice that Jared Kushner gave him was bad.
Every piece of advice.
All the time you're hearing, you would hear, and obviously we only hear through the grapevine and all that, but it just seemed like constantly Jared Kushner was thwarting any sort of productive action.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pointing down bad alleys and stuff. Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable.
If he learned nothing and forgot nothing. He's got a long list of grudges because he's an egomaniac. And if he gets into the presidency, he will be going through this long list of petty grudges and avenging himself, ticking these things off. Now, of course, these are grudges against people in the establishment. And so, as far as I'm concerned, they all deserve to suffer terribly. And so it'll be fun if Trump actually goes on his revenge tour. But he's learned nothing about governing. And so it'll just be a wasted opportunity. Trump is not going to save America. Years ago, before he was even elected, this fellow that I knew through the TRS Facebook group, when that was centered in a Facebook book group, I think he went by the name Raiden. He said something very wise. He said, Trump isn't our last hope. Trump is the system's last hope. Trump could have kept this multicultural, multiracial, civic nationalist system that's in place. He could have kept it going by putting it on firmer foundations, a little bit more realist, a little bit more populist, make white people happy. He wasn't allowed to do that. He was the last hope of that system to stabilize. And Senile Joe, Genocide Joe, it's pedal to the metal, great replacement. It's destabilizing the whole thing. It's going to make it easier for us to overthrow this system, honestly, if we have incompetent government rather than incompetent government. Fortunately, Trump will be incompetent. Trump will do nothing necessary to save their system. And he might do stuff to slow down the Great Replacement. But I think this system is beyond repair, beyond recall. And that's good. I think our worst enemies are conservatives. Our worst enemies are conservatives who would make sure that there's sound money for the brown people. A functioning economy for the people who will come to replace us. I don't want this system to work. I do not want a system where race replacement is built in, being put on sound economic and law and order foundations. I don't want that to happen. And fortunately, Trump won't give us that. So it's a matter of indifference to me, whether it's Trump or Senile Joe at this point. I used to hold out hope that somebody like Trump could save America. And somebody could save America. If you had an inspired politician who could go in and use the powers of his office, and maybe if you... ex officio powers, a bit of skullduggery. It could be done. It could be done in a bloodless way. There'd be a lot of screaming, but there would be no actual bloodshed. But no, I don't think we're going to get that.
Just on the matter of missed opportunities and how much Trump threw that away and might throw it away again by... well, if nothing else, bringing Jared Kushner back in. That reminded me of something, because you also mentioned wasted opportunities earlier on. And we also mentioned Tucker Carlson earlier on. And this is something that I thought would come up on Millennial this year. And it's come up, so I'll say this now. I just want to make the point that I was astonished at how much potential there was when Tucker Carlson got fired from Fox. And it was clear that he had an open field on Twitter. And yeah. Elon Musk would back him up. He wouldn't get censored. He wouldn't get banned. And there was this real anticipation for what is Tucker going to do now? You know, what will Tucker do next kind of thing? It's going to be huge. It's going to be great. He's going to be unfettered and all this kind of stuff. And then he ends up doing this interview with some fuckwit who claims that he had sex with Barack, like a gay guy who had sex with Barack Obama in the late 90s. And things like that, I couldn't believe it. Because, I mean, who cares? Who gives a shit? Even if it's true, I don't know if it is true, but...
I am not hearing you at all. You have become completely muted.
Really?
And I'm not sure what the hell I've done.
Oh, no.
Yeah, if it's...
Do you want to exit?
My doing or not.
You should exit and rejoin. Hold on a second.
So, sorry about this.
Don't worry.
I hope you can hear me, but I can't hear anything on your end. Do you want to... maybe I could just log out and log back in and try and get back in the stream. I think I'm going to have to do that. This is something with my computers acting up. So just bear with me. I apologize.
That's fine. Well, I'm sure that you all heard this at home. Let's see what's going on. This is obviously a problem with live streaming. It's a bit rough and ready. These things happen. Let's see. Yes, you hear both of us. I thought so too. I think he's probably pressed mute or something. Let's see. Damn, it was a good rant I was on it as well about Tucker. let's see. Oh, right. He's okay. You've got to leave. Let's see what's going on here. Right. Okay. Right. Hello. Greg, you obviously can't hear me. Oh, bloody hell. Hello, can you hear me now?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, dear God.
Okay. All right, I'll tell him to restart his computer. Okay, can you hear me, Greg? No, I can hear you.
Hey, Woz, are you there?
Yes.
Oh, thank God. Well, I managed to get back. So are we live?
Yes. We're still live. Yes, yes, yes.
Okay.
Right. Excellent. So what was the last thing you heard?
Oh.
I was ranting about Tucker.
Tucker, yeah. What a huge disappointment. He could have done so much. He could have done so much. And what did he do? The Tate brothers. Gonzalo Lira. All this UFOs, all this stuff.
The example I was using was that guy who claimed to have had sex with Obama in the late.
Yeah,
and it's just
a total waste.
Total waste. It could have been revolutionary. I thought this was going to be huge. I think his first show had something like 10 million viewers or something. It was actually more than had watched him on Fox, and somehow I don't know how he messed this up. It's one of those.
I'm afraid.
How did he manage this?
Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting. I've seen something like this with other people over the years who have gotten into our politics, and they've gotten out there a little much, said a few things that are a little too spicy, and then they feel exposed and they feel panicky, and so they try and hedge. And one of the things they'll do is they'll do the standard, I'm an individualist, I only see individuals. They'll say something a little collectivist, maybe. They notice groups and how they work, but then they say, but I'm blind to all that and stupid. You can sucker me. You can sucker me so you don't have to destroy my life. That's one of the ways that they'll hedge. The other way they'll hedge is they'll think, well, I need some camouflage here, right? I know. I'll just camouflage myself as a harmless crank. Yeah, Tucker talks about white genocide, but Tucker talks about anything. He'll believe anything. He'll have this crank on talking about doing meth and having sex with Obama. He'll have these pimps, the Tates on. He'll talk to Gonzalo Lira, sex tourist and pest and parasite and spy, right? And fake victim, Tawana Brawley type. He'll have anybody on. You don't have to worry about old Tucker. He's just a harmless crank. I'm afraid that might be the kind of thinking that's going on here, but he's sure blunted his force.
First of all, it doesn't work. Because
it doesn't work.
And second, because your enemies will still attack you, and they will use the lowbrow material to bolster their attack.
Yeah.
They'll say, not only do you go flirt with white genocide replacement stuff, not only that, you're also into other conspiracy stuff like UFOs and whatever. So that, not only does it not work, but secondly, it repels sensible people on the right.
Yeah,
because they think this is just a load of kooky nonsense, and Tucker isn't taking this seriously. He's not taking his job seriously. And I'm not saying that's the case. I think he might think that this is the right thing to do. I think he's degrading himself, degrading his platform, and
he's making himself less useful.
An opportunity of a lifetime.
Absolutely, it's absolutely a crime. It's the biggest disappointment for me of 2023 is Tucker Carlson on X, on Twitter. It's the biggest disappointment, the biggest wasted opportunity of 2023.
Yeah. Sometimes it's a thing with the right that we seem to make terrible decisions without any help from the feds.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That happens time and again. Mind you, I'm not saying that the feds weren't involved there. I don't know. I have no idea what was going on. I just think he could do, and he could still do better. Let's say he could turn it around. He could put this fucking nonsense aside and just talk about stuff that really matters. Because God knows, there's no shortage of it.
Yeah, I completely agree. I'm glad the two of us are on the same page about this. I have friends who, they're mad at me because I won't read their stuff. I won't click the link. Oh, did you see Tucker? No, I didn't click the link. Sorry.
I was still looking forward to it being like a regular thing. I'll watch. I'll have the Tucker's latest program playing while I'm doing other stuff. I thought that was how it was going to be.
Yeah.
And then it started. I can't remember what the first few episodes were, but the Obama thing was early on, and it immediately made me think, oh no.
Oh no. Yeah.
And the thing is, maybe it's true, maybe it's not true. It doesn't. I don't care.
I don't care. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Obama, apart from anything else, Obama has been out of power for 7 years.
He's been out. Exactly. I don't care if it, I don't care if his wife has a penis either. The kind of stupid shit that, that people want to talk about. It's like, you'd think we live in a world where, you know, that's not ending, where people can talk about stupid shit like this.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the thing. It's like, don't you realize? Because he does seem to realize. Sometimes he says it, like, you know, Western civilization's in danger and all that. But yeah, and someone did point out in the chat that apparently he said just in the last week or two that he doesn't see race, this kind of boomerism stuff, you know?
Yeah, that he wants to go back to that wonderful world before identity politics, when, you know, Republicans were still losing, of course, but... they didn't have to take uncomfortable stands. He wants to go back to that. They think that that's the way out. Of course, it's not.
This is like the Sargon thing, where the way we'll win is by drawing people away from identity politics back to values and principles.
Yeah.
Let's not get into that now. All right, so we'll get to the super chats.
Okay.
All right, let's see.
Folks, send Woz some fat super chats. He deserves your support for the work that he's doing.
Thank you. I won't disagree with Greg on that. Okay, let's see. One of my favorite quips, this is Potato Mutt, one of my favorite quips from Greg is when he said he wishes people would read Frank Herbert the same way they read Ayn Rand. Is Greg familiar with the works of Gene Wolfe?
No, I'm not familiar with the works of Gene Wolfe. If you can recommend a good place to start, I'll dip in.
All right. And Maximus Gibbs said, "'Tis better to Gibbs. Merry Christmas all." Thank you very much. Open Borders for Israel says... I love that name. Huge fan of Greg and his alter ego, Trevor Lynch. Would Greg think about starting an Odyssey page and doing movie reviews?
Well, I've been doing less of that reviewing stuff. There was a period of 2 years where I was doing two reviews a month over at Un's Review. And then I had to step away from that because I was creating the Homeland Institute starting at the beginning of 2022. And I also wanted to write this book, The Great Replacement. Well, I'd love to go back to that. In fact, I'm going to email Ron Unz today. I'll do it tomorrow, actually. I'm going to email Ron. I'm just going to write this down, Unz, U-N-Z. One of the secrets to being successful is to keep a notebook and jot things down. So I'm going to email Ron and say, do you want me back every other week or twice a month, I guess, at Un's Review? Because I'd like to do more movie reviews. The guy who does the audio movie review stuff really, really well is Frody Midyord with his Decameron Film Festival. So I don't want to compete with that, but I love coming on Decameron. I've done it 3 times now. The last Decameron appearance I did was on Once Upon a Time in the West by Sergio Leone. And that rung a pretty good essay out of Trevor Lynch. And Trevor hasn't been writing a lot on films for the past couple of years. So, yeah, I find it engaging, though. And I would like to do more of it in 2024. And let's see if Ron wants to have me back on his platform.
All right. Excellent. And in the middle of that, Greg casually gave some advice, which is excellent advice, which I've echoed. I'll say it again in my own way. Every idea that you have, write it down. That's an extremely good piece of advice because you will forget things. You just will. So it's important to have a place, not just a to-do list, but long-term ideas that you might pick up on in the future.
Yeah.
All right. We'll return to this. Lady of Shalott, hello, says, I always use the phrase anti-white, never the phrase woke, when talking to normies. Their initial reaction to anti-white is a good guide on how far you can try and take them. Increasingly, they will immediately agree that something is anti-white. We are winning people over.
I agree with that completely.
Yeah, that's good. Noticer-in-Chief says, Countercurrents plus Woes and or Morgoth would be a great regular monthly, perhaps, stream. Cheers, both. Thank you for saying that. That's something.
Yes, thank you.
Darby, the John Fettermans will inherit America.
And then they'll starve because they're basically vegetables. Other people will eat them, yes, perhaps, but they will starve.
Okay. Magic Man in the Sky says something that I'm not going to read out on air. Thank you for that. Heraclitus. Greg, I think you do tremendous work with Countercurrents and have done so for many years. I wish you the best of luck with all your projects and Countercurrents in 2024. And for Woes, would you be interested in submitting some of your longer essays to Countercurrents rather than Substack? And then the rest of your question has unfortunately been cut off, I think. Yeah, that's rather unfortunate. No, I can't see the rest of it. Well, we'll see about that. I think that we have discussed doing that. The thing with being a content creator and having your own social media platform is that you inevitably want to grow that platform. And yeah. So you want to channel your energies into that thing. But the advantage with something like Countercurrents is that you won't get deplatformed from it, and it's a sort of meeting place, much in the same way that Millennial is a meeting place of it, where you can encounter many different writers. So, I mean, I have had one or two essays published on Countercurrents in the past, so yeah. I'm certainly not averse to that. Greg and I are good friends, so maybe that will happen in the future. That's really up to Greg.
Well, yeah, your work is welcome. Somebody asked me about Substack recently, and I said, I'm very jealous of Substack because Morgoth has his platform on Substack and Woes and Endeavor, and all, I have all these friends publishing there, and I wish they just all bring it over to Countercurrents. And, let me know what you're getting per essay at Substack. And let me try and beat it. Let's continue this conversation off the air, though.
Okay, all right. And then finally, Ritkuli sends what looks like a polar bear's face. I think that's an emoji of, I'm not sure, of an, it's an ice bear, I think it is. So yes, thank you for that. I think that's all of them on, oh, here's Asai Rising. When I was a lad, I served a term as an office boy in a clergy firm. I washed the windows and swept the floor and polished up the handle on the big front door. I have no idea what that is, but thank you for that that message. Okay, I hope it's not some. Have I just read out some piece of huge concentrated hate speech without knowing it? I hope not.
No, I think it's just
right. Okay. All right, that's all of those. Well, we talked about Elon Musk quite extensively earlier, but here is a question that you could try to answer concisely. Would Elon Musk contribute more by using money to form lawsuits? Media Matters and ADL getting sued requires money, and no super rich guy ever called out anti-white racism before. What could Musk's best contributions to our side be, in your view?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would like to see more lawfare on our side. There are many lawyers who are movement people. They agree with us on important issues. And I think a lot of money is being left on the table, though, when, for instance, this woman got millions of dollars for being discriminated against as a white person by Starbucks in Philadelphia, I think it was. That's the kind of suits that you know, you could have a whole law firm working away on that kind of stuff for our site. It would be nice to have a white public interest law firm. We have all the lawyers really we need. And, you know, having an institution won't create any lawyers in the short run. But when it comes to finding lawyers to defend our people who are being persecuted, I mean, there are lawyers out there. So
yeah, it's a matter of paying them,
it's a matter of paying them. Yeah, the real problem is not the expertise, and it's not really infrastructure so much as it's the ability to pay. But I do think that having people who fund these sorts of suits is hugely important. Backers for these kinds of lawsuits are hugely important. And that's one of the most important things that can be done, is if you have a good case that can be, you know, a binding precedent case law that can overthrow elements of the anti-white regime, the censorship regime, et cetera, and you've got a good lawyer, and you know, you've got to find donors who will put the money up for that. I think that's a gigantically important thing to do. Now, will Elon Musk be that guy? I don't know. Probably not, or probably not stuff that's immediately adjacent to our movement, but stuff that could have ripple effects that could be helpful. But, you know, you don't have to be the richest man in the world to fund important lawsuits. So, waiting for Elon Musk to do it would leave a lot of things in the lurch. So we shouldn't be waiting for Elon swooping in a white Tesla, right? We need to take advantage of all the people that we already have, and we don't necessarily have, nobody has pockets as deep as his, but a lot of people have pockets that are deep enough. So yeah, it would be good to find a way of networking more with lawyers. That's a project that I actually have on the agenda for 2024 in the United States. I want to get conversations going to create a nationalist lawyers network or guild in the United States.
Right. Okay, that sounds very useful. The person clarified that rhyme was from a Gilbert and Sullivan opera, and calls me an ingrate for not knowing that. I am sorry. The only Gilbert and Sullivan song I know is about the gondoliers, which I find quite amusing. But other than that, I'm quite an ignoramus about Gilbert and Sullivan. My apologies. All right. Somebody asks. Well, someone says the following: Greg, if you had your exact same views, but as a Jewish person in Israel, you would be hailed as a great man and given money and media prestige. How do Jews accomplish this support for one another that whites have such trouble achieving?
Well, Jews are normal. That's what we have to understand. Jews are normal. They may be a little neurotic, a little over intense, a little over complex, maybe. They might go about it in the wrong way. It might be cringe. But Jews are basically a normal group of people in the sense that they're ethnocentric, that they take their own side in the fight. Now, that's overlaid with all kinds of neuroses and, you know, superstitions and, bad manners and stuff like that. They could go about this better. They could be less offensive. And the worst thing about Jewish ethnocentrism is basically they want ethnocentrism for themselves, but they want to preach universalism for other people. They have a live and let die philosophy rather than a live and let live philosophy. And that's what makes them dangerous people. They want ethnostates for themselves. They want to deny it for other people. They would be much happier if they weren't at odds with the continued existence of the rest of the planet. But I don't think that they're ever going to learn that lesson, to be honest. I just don't think there are enough sensible Jews to prevent the tragic consequences of this these double standards and these aggressive attitudes towards other people. And there are good Jews. There are good Jews with consciences and foresight and sensibility who see the problem, but there just aren't enough of them, sadly. So, but Jewish ethnocentrism, Jewish nationalism, this is normal. This is normal for all peoples. What makes it obnoxious is they want to deny the benefits of this to other people, and they want to benefit from denying that to other people. If you read Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism, he's a very sensible 19th century nationalist. And he says things about the causes of anti-Semitism that would get a non-Jew branded an anti-Semite. It's very funny. He talks about how Jews have an abusive relationship with their Gentile host populations, basically. And this is the cause of anti-Semitism, and that this problem will disappear if Jews leave other people's countries, leave off being a diaspora people, and form their own homeland and become a normal people in a normal land. The Zionist project is something that I think is absolute ethno-nationalism 101 applied to Jews. And I support it as a matter of general principle. And the only thing that I regret is that it wasn't completed, because the main problems that we have with Jews in the diaspora is, well, diaspora Jewry. And the main reason why Israel is such a bad neighbor and such an aggressive bully is because the Jewish diaspora in the United States has such power over U.S. foreign policy that they can basically underwrite bellicose attitudes on the part of Israel. And so, honestly, I think it's the problem of the diaspora that causes Israel to be a problem. And if the Zionist project were actually completed, if they all went to Israel and Israel had to just make nice and be a normal nation, I think that we would have a much better world. And I think we would start to have better relations with Jews. Even I would start having better relations with Jews. So those are my thoughts.
All right. How can they turn that down? All right. Okay, there is a question that's a bit awkward because it's an ongoing thing in America just now with one of the organizations. And I have generally had good relations with TRS in the past, and I hope that, you know, I have nothing against them. I don't want to scupper that. But this question has been asked, so I will give it to Greg. What do you think about the situation with the NJP?
Well, the NJP is basically shut down. It's been around for more than 3 years. I remember 3 years ago when Mike Enoch gave a speech, I think I saw it on Twitter. I guess he was on there. It was his speech announcing the formation of the NJP. I thought it was a very credible speech, and I was thinking, well, this could be a really good thing. And then he introduced the other people who were founding the party with him. And there were three people that I didn't know. And then there were three people who came out, Greg Conti, Tony Hovater, and Eric Stryker. And my heart sank because these people had been intimately involved with some of the disasters that had come before, the Matt Heim debacle and the Richard Spencer debacle. It turns out that those three guys have all left the party, and basically the party blew up, I guess, in a conflict between Heimbach Hovater and Stryker. And now they basically just canceled it. They've shut it down. And Mike is talking about just encouraging local pool party groups to do whatever level of activism they want. And so it's going to go back to the pre-party days. I don't know if they can do that because they've showed a great deal of their credibility. Because this whole thing has happened in a very public way. It's what you'd expect. It's Jerry Springer nationalism. Sven, who for years was shilling NJP as the only thing, everybody else is fake. You know, all the other groups are crap. Only by NJP snake oil, not these other groups. He went on and he encouraged this attitude of being a very bad team player in the greater movement to flog the NJP as like a product, right? A product. Now he's out there saying, I never was behind this. I was waiting for it to fail. All these weirdos needed to be gotten rid of. This was Mike's side project. Okay, well, if that's what he believed, then he was lying to people for 3.5 years to fleece them of their money, to fleece them of their donations, their dues to that party. If he thought this was a side project, a waste of time, populated by weirdos, then he shouldn't have been shilling it, and he shouldn't have been denigrating the rest of the movement to do it. He shouldn't have been involved in fed jacketing people who were doing well outside the sphere of his little project. And so, honestly, I don't think that their credibility will recover from this. This is a serious blow to their credibility. But the model that's being proposed is much better. I mean, they've shut down the party, and they want to go back to basically encouraging local activism from their pool party groups. Some of those groups are full of really high-quality people, and they do really good work.
It did seem to work very well, the pool party stuff. I remember it was something that people had a lot of optimism about. Yeah. It seemed to energize and it seemed to be good. So I think if that is what works, then they should go back to it. Yeah. What I would say, I mean, I'm not involved, and I've really had very little contact with that whole sphere since 2017. I mean, that wasn't really a conscious decision on my part. It was just that we drifted apart. It's a natural thing. But what it seems to me is that they attempted something not realizing how difficult it would be, and they got overwhelmed. I mean, I think it's happened many times. I don't know. I don't have any particular beef with them. And I hope that they... Yeah, I don't want to see them humiliated. However, what you've said about Seventh Son and others, bad-mouthing other people in the movement, that is never a good idea. And I've said this so many times. It really, you know, to answer the previous question that came in, how do Jews accomplish this solidarity? One of the ways is that they don't do each other down in this competitive way. We can't afford that level of competition. This is not... The market is not that big, so we would be far better supporting each other and not doing each other down. That's what I would say. And so Seventh Son, I didn't really see much from him especially, but I saw it generally coming out of NJP, a sort of negative attitude towards the rest of the movement.
And I think it was basically Stryker was one of the main voices for that.
And I don't think that did them any favors, and I doubt that it actually helped them.
No, it just created this feeling like they're just a kind of Amway thing, you know, snake oil salesman slash cult is really the feel of it. It had a cult feel, but it also had a very, very bottom line oriented, hustling business kind of feel to it. And that's Sven, apparently. He's a real, you know, and Sven and McNabb in the fallouts, you know, all of this has been aired in front of the kids, right? And it's gone out to the world. All the screaming has gone out to the world. They were obviously extremely cynical about this, and they just thought it was a distraction from making money with TRS. And I had heard rumbles to this effect long before this happened, and that it seems to be completely borne out by what's gone public. I think it's good, though, because I think the leadership of the NJP was inferior to the rank and file. And I think that they are basically, these people were being fleeced of money, and that they were given nothing for this except a bad image caused by some of these kooks like Stryker. And now they're released, and I think there'll be a lot of positive activism and community building now that this party structure has basically ceased to exist. So that's a good thing. That's a good thing. However, I think Sven has a real black eye, a real credibility problem, and it shocks me that he's aired his cynicism about this in public. Because for years, he was relentlessly shilling this as the only way forward. And now we learned that he just thought this was a waste of time. And he was waiting for it to die. He was waiting for it to die. But don't you dare get in arrears on your dues while he waits for this project to die. It's so cynical. It stinks to the high heavens.
Very unfortunate. As I said, from my point of view, looking at it charitably, as someone who doesn't wish them any ill, I've got no beef against them, my impression is that they started something not realizing how difficult it was going to be.
Right.
And certainly Mike, I think. And yeah, that's my impression of it. That's all I'll say. I also think it's just unfortunate when any of this stuff goes public, because people fall out. You know, people fall out all the time.
Yeah.
And it's better if it's just kept behind closed doors.
Yeah, exactly. And there are a number of things. It would be nice if there are ways of mediating these things without going public. That would be a huge improvement over the current situation. But what you have is you have a movement full of cliques, and you've got these movements where people shun one another. You know, I put out 5 years ago now, the White Nationalist Manifesto came out 5 years ago. And I put a lot of work into that. I thought it was a pretty darn good book. I thought it was useful. I thought, okay, anybody who's serious about white nationalism might want to see the arguments in here, right? And there were entire swaths of the American movement, TRS included, that pretended that that book simply did not exist. Spencer and his people, they just pretended it didn't exist. I just think that's utterly contemptible. And it's like, it's the schoolyard. It's childish schoolyard cliques, not a serious movement. And again, that to me just impeached the credibility of vast swaths of the movement, that they just pretended this book didn't exist. They didn't even give any evidence of reading it, even out of curiosity, right? Even to give it a negative review. Mike, you know, had gone silent on me, for, you know, they threw me out of their circles in 2017. This was Sven's behavior. It was connected with the first Scanza forum and the attempts to shut that down by, Daniel Freeberg and Richard Spencer, they were all involved in this. And Sven sided with them, and I was radiated from their groups. I was banished from their groups. And Mike would occasionally contact me if he wanted a favor. And sometime in 2019, he contacted me and he wanted a favor. And I said, you know, Mike, I'm fine doing favors with you, but I want it on a quid pro quo basis from now on. When are you going to do something about the White Nationalist Manifesto? Crickets. Not a peep. That was the last I heard of him till I bumped into him at a meeting a couple of years later. I'm bitter about that. But I look at this from the point of view of just somebody thinking, okay, if I hadn't written that book, I would be the first person to buy it, even if I didn't like the author. Why? Because I want my arguments to be better. Right? Why? Because this is more than just playground cliques and
I agree. And
egoism.
That's what I would say about this. Even if you don't like someone, you should always be thinking, what is good for the movement? What is good for the cause? Again, this is what our opponents do. This is how they win, because your own beef with someone isn't as important as what you're all actually fighting for, and what you've committed your life to, after all. So that's what I would remind everyone of in all of this. All right, Black Pigeon Pilled asks you, when do you think the West's cultural pendulum will swing back to the right? We've kind of been addressing that all throughout the stream.
I kind of think it already is, to be honest. But that pendulum is going to have to... It's going to have to swing hard and swing deep and clear away a lot of trash. And there's going to be a huge amount of resistance to that. Again, we could fix the West without any blood, just a whole lot of screaming from the left. We could do it. But of course they're not going to allow that to happen. It's going to get really nasty, I'm afraid. These people have shown that they will do anything dishonorable, and there's no level of dishonor that they're unwilling to take upon their filthy souls to maintain the positions that they're in. But I think the momentum is already moving in our direction on the deep level in terms of ideas. What is happening, though, with politics is that politics always lags behind the intellectual sphere. And I think that there's going to be a lot of purely political conflict before the institutional power of the left is finally cleared away. And that's going to make for some very interesting times.
All right. And let's see the next one. While Dr. Johnson is the philosophy lecturer we all wish we'd had, I notice Greg talks lots about psychology. Did he ever study that? And why does he think that field is so full of leftists and frauds?
That's a really cool question. I'm interested in psychology. I never studied it in an academic sort of way. I'm trying to think. I took one introduction to psychology class my first year as an undergraduate, but I've always been interested in psychology, and I've always read a lot of psychology. I think that you can't do philosophy without understanding psychology, especially moral philosophy. And so, for instance... I think the core of Plato's philosophy and Socrates' philosophy, the philosophy that you get from the lips of Socrates and Plato's dialogues, the core of it is an account of the human soul and what makes it healthy and what makes it sick. That's absolutely central to Greek philosophy, and that's a kind of psychology. So, I mean, psychology literally means giving a logos of the psyche, an account of the soul. And you find that both Plato and Aristotle do that. They give accounts of the soul. There's a book by Aristotle called De Anima, Peri Psyche, on the soul. It's a work of psychology, philosophical psychology. So I've always been interested in moral psychology, I guess, because I've always been interested in moral and political philosophy. And the people that I've learned the most about psychology from are actually philosophers. The psychology that I find most useful to this day is Plato. Plato's psychology, Plato's account of the soul in the Republic. Another philosopher whose psychological speculations and thoughts are absolutely core to his ideas is Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And I'm a huge Rousseauian in many ways. I'm a great fan of Rousseau. Rousseau's question was, why is modern man so miserable? You know, man is born free and everywhere he's in chains. What makes this happen and how can we legitimate it? Those are two questions. It's interesting. He wants to legitimate the chains of civilization in the end. He thinks that we are going to be enchained, but there are some chains that are just and others unjust. But he gives an account of how people become enslaved to false and unhealthy forms of hierarchy. And it has everything to do with what you can call the psychology of narcissism. He wrote a book on child development called Emile, which deals with the way of basically sidestepping having narcissistic dependent personalities, because he thought that that was the way forward to create a freer society. So all of this is absolutely central to my thinking. Nietzsche, of course, had a lot of psychological insights. So I am big on psychology, but I got most of my psychology from philosophy. Now, I did read a whole lot of Freud in the 90s. You know, a lot of people poo-poo Freud, well, because of his ethnicity and his agendas, etc., or because it doesn't pass muster in terms of empirical psychology. And a lot of it just isn't true, right? But a lot of it's really profound. But here's the thing. A lot of it's borrowed from philosophy. So the biggest influence on Freud's thinking about psychology was Schopenhauer's philosophy, interestingly enough. Schopenhauer was another great philosophical psychologist. So yeah, psychology is very important to me, but that's because it's integral to philosophy as I understand it.
All right. Then there was one more. This is from K Max. When a leftist tries to obscure the issue and say, what is white culture? Would the answer simply be the things that they attack us for?
Absolutely. That's the way that I say, you know, people say, oh, you can't define whiteness. It's like, wait, no, we can define white people. White people are the ones who have all the white guilt, right? The way they play these silly, stupid, dishonest little games is whenever we try and take our own side, they want to say, well, define who's white. They have no trouble defining who's white when it comes to blaming us for problems, but they will try these sophistries when we try and get uppity. And the response to that is basically, who are the white people? The people who have white guilt. What is white culture? It's the stuff that all of the non-whites appropriate, gladly appropriate. That's white culture.
What I would just to, sorry.
Go ahead.
I just don't answer this question anymore because I don't believe it's ever asked in good faith.
It's never asked in good faith. Yeah.
So I just ask them, well, what is black culture? What is Pakistani culture?
We don't need to define our culture. Go ahead. We just don't need to define it. Some things can't be defined. There's this term called the Socratic fallacy. it's something that Socrates wasn't guilty of. The Socratic fallacy is the claim that if you can't define something, then you don't know what it is. The truth is that knowledge is always richer than our ability to articulate what we know. And therefore, our ability to articulate and define our knowledge will always lag behind what we already know. And if we can't articulate it, that doesn't mean that we don't know it. And culture is preeminently the kind of knowledge that can't be fully articulated, because it's mostly a way of being, a way of feeling, a way of acting. It's not just words, right? It's a shared way of life. A shared way of life can never be fully, meaningfully articulated, and it doesn't have to be. And it is a question in bad faith.
Yes, I agree. All right, well, let's see. The other super chats are not questions as such. Sovereign Eye says, your work is highly valued, and that's addressed to me, but I'm sure it also means the same to you, Greg. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Lee says, all the best. Thank you. Ben says, all the best, Woz. You do a great job with Millennial and have a lovely Christmas. Thank you very much, Ben, and the same to you. I think that's them all. So, well, this has been a very thorough stream and longer than I'd intended. The next stream with Culture Dads is not cancelled. It will be beginning imminently. But it's because some people were asking if it's been cancelled.
Oh, no. I didn't realize we've run over. It was fun. And I had a tech moment there, so... Anyway, thank you so much for having me on. I've really enjoyed this. I always enjoy doing this, and I would love to be back next year for Millennial. And, of course, we'll be doing other things in the meantime. I think 2024 is going to be a very rich year for our movement. The economy is really sucks, but as long as we can hold on, I think that we will stay in the game. One thing about the alt-light... one thing about them is that these people spent money like mad. They got tons of money. They had tons of money. They burned through a lot of this money. And when they got deplatformed, they went away. They weren't serious about it. People like me, people like Woz, we're notoriously cheap. We're notoriously cheap. I'm willing to sacrifice a lot of things, but I'm not willing to sacrifice my freedom to speak the truth as I see it every day for the rest of my life. And 2024 is going to be a very rich year for that kind of commentary. And I'm going to be here, and I know Woz is going to be in the game as well. So I'm looking forward to it. Be of good cheer.
Indeed. I agree. I have nothing to say about that, just because I want to. I don't want to keep the next streamers waiting. So
I'm looking forward to hearing them and not hearing any more of myself. So thank you.
That's okay. It's been a very good stream. So Greg, thank you very much. I'll be back soon. And in the meantime, yes, Greg, thank you for maintaining this unbroken record of appearing on Millennial every year.
Wonderful.
All right. Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Find the info at millennial.com/crypto and make your donation. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.